Duval County is back open along with much of the Sunshine State. There have been arrests in the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man in Brunswick, Georgia. And more JEA news stemming from that investigation into the now halted sale of the utility. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week on our Friday roundtable. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, he's unemployed and hiking all the way across the state of Florida to call attention to the thousands in this state who are out of work. We'll have his story. But first, it's Friday, and we're going to break down another busy week in the news as we welcome Karen Mathis of the Jax Daily Record. Hi, Karen.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you. Also with us, David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union.
Good morning, everybody.
Hey, David. And rounding out our panel, WJCT's digital editor, Bill Bortsfield. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, everybody.
So good to have all of you with us. Lots to talk about this week. First, though, let me get the latest on the air by the numbers on the COVID crisis. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health is now reporting 38,828 coronavirus cases and 1,600 deaths. In our area, there are 1,799 cases and 59 deaths. Two of the new deaths happened in Duval County in the last 24 hours, a 74-year-old woman and a 69-year-old woman. Now, amid those numbers, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry says Jacksonville is cautiously moving forward to reopen the local economy. The mayor is urging residents to wear masks as they venture out into public places like restaurants and retail stores. Those stores and restaurants are now able to all operate at 25% indoor capacity. But the mayor is reminding people to be cautious, to continue practicing social distancing, and to not gather in groups of 10 or more people. Meanwhile, more testing sites are opening up around town, and you also will soon be able to get tested for antibodies to the coronavirus at the testing site at TIAA Bank Field downtown. So as we kick things off, we want to know, give us a call and let us know, how do you feel about the reopening this week in Jacksonville? Have you gone into a restaurant or a retail store, or are you still avoiding them? The number to join us is 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Karen Bruni Mathis, let's begin with you. You speak to commercial real estate people, retail people a lot as editor of the Jax Daily Record. What are they telling you about the reopening at 25% capacity? Are customers coming into stores?
Well, I was surprised because I went out to the St. John's Town Center opening, and I expected there to be a lot more people, a lot more customers there than there were. Not very many stores were open, and those that were, most of them had either a capacity where, you know, one person in, one person out, or you had to wear a mask. The door was locked. You had to be allowed in. Some you could just walk in and follow the path, but there really weren't very many people out there. And the restaurants were starting to open too, but they weren't all open either. And what I'm hearing from some of the retail brokers is that people are very cautious about reopening. Mm-hmm. They want to make sure that they have the capacity to reopen, that the customers are there because they have to pay staff, of course. And they think this whatever is going to happen as a result of the pandemic is going to be long-lasting.
Yeah, David Bauerlein, on the one hand, businesses do need to get revenue going. On the other hand, there, as Karen says, there are liability concerns. Customers are quite wary. We aren't back to where we were before by any means, are we?
Not at all. I mean, it's kind of a case of trying to get back to a pre-coronavirus way of life with the post-coronavirus safeguards. And it's a real balancing act in terms of those behaviors. I had the same impression that that Karen had, in that, you know, there are stores that I've called just personally that I'd like to go back and check out, and they're either not open yet or they're still maybe doing things on the curbside. I'm talking about stuff like, say, bookstores, the Shamblin's, for instance. So I think there is a real, even notwithstanding anything the government's doing to ease restrictions, each of these individual retail establishments are looking at what their sort of approach is going to be, and understanding that it's maybe not like the beach where, you know, you lifted the restrictions on the beach and, yeah, everybody said, let's go to the beach. And I resume that. It's a different thing when you're going indoors to a retail establishment or a restaurant in terms of how people approach that individually, much less how the government approaches that.
And Bill Bortsfield, amidst all this, there have been local stimulus payments handed out to people who are struggling, along with some support for small businesses. At the same time, Mayor Curry is talking about expanded testing sites for Jacksonville. There are several of them, and we will apparently have access to antibody testing for free at the TIAA Bank Field site fairly soon. I'm sure there'll be a fair number of people that are curious to see if they have antibodies to the virus.
Yeah, of course, both Governor DeSantis and Mayor Curry have talked about the antibody test coming to Jacksonville. But of course, then there's the uncertainty even surrounding that, because as we know, there are scientists that are saying they're just not sure whether the antibody tests are going to really show immunity, because there's so much that we just don't know about this disease. And going back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, with the restaurants, and my gosh, just looking at these job numbers this morning, I mean, I'm looking at an NPR story right now, and one of the key sentences in my mind is the highest monthly job loss before this was 2 million in 1945 as the nation began to demobilize after World War II. So we're really seeing the worst monthly job loss in a very long time. It's just staggering what we're seeing. And that also goes back to what Karen and David were talking about in terms of the businesses. Of course, there's the safety aspect, but there's also the question of consumers and folks that have lost their jobs, even if they'd be willing to go out and maybe spend money for a nice dinner, whether they can afford to do so right now.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Karen Mathis, you know, the mayor is saying that before long, we will move here in Jacksonville past this phase one of the reopening process to phase two, based on guidelines from the White House, where we'd see a fuller reopening of the state. The mayor has pointed out we have fewer than 100 deaths of COVID-19 in our area. Hospital beds are not at capacity. He's basing these moves on those numbers. At the same time, we're hearing from public health experts, epidemiologists, that if we relax things too much, we will see a spike in cases. And they really have tried to send the reminder that the virus is still with us. The other day, we interviewed the president of the Florida Academy of Family Physicians. She's based here in Jacksonville, and she begged people to continue staying home as much as possible, wear masks if you have to go into a public place. She said she's concerned about this reopening for the reasons of people are still at risk.
Yes. People are still at risk, and a lot of people do still feel at risk. And this raises the question of when do offices and office buildings start opening? We're getting a lot of questions from businesses saying, you know, when are we going to be allowed to reopen, you know, our brick and mortar offices? And we don't know that yet. I don't think that the mayor has addressed that yet. But a lot of people are putting plans into place. How are we going to do that when that happens? But the question there is, I don't know how businesses are going to be able to make their employees come into the office if the employees do not feel safe to come into the office for health reasons. A lot of those questions are out there, and this also may lead to a much more permanent status of people being able to work from home. I don't know. I hear a lot of people say they're more productive working from home.
Mm-hmm. Sure. David, the workplace coming out of this crisis, we could see profound changes in not just in office culture, but all manner of things. I mean, you know, Dr. Anthony Fauci, our national expert on the virus, he has said, I hope that the one thing that comes out of this is that people stop shaking hands.
You know? We're all going to do elbow bumps. yes, exactly. There's going to be changes long-term in behavior. And I do think that the trend towards doing more at-home work is going to continue. If businesses actually think that's workable and that they can actually save money in their overhead by doing it that way. There's a lot of advantages, I think, to everybody being in the office together. But I think you're right. I mean, one of the recommendations that I saw that the CDC put out in a report that everything was never really acted on at the federal level was, you know, when you have a school, instead of everybody going into the lunchroom, lunches will be provided in the classroom. Well, that's just a big change, isn't it? I mean, everybody remembers, you know, piling into the lunchroom and going through the cafeteria line. And, you know, that could be a change where, you know, maybe in the future, if they want to reopen schools, everybody gets served lunch in a classroom, so you avoid those huge gatherings. And that may be the biggest change, is this real change in the big, large crowds, and nobody knows how long that prohibition is going to stay in place. And there's so many things that people like to do, whether they're in a big group, whether it's at work or going to a football game or baseball game or a concert. There's really no end in sight in terms of how that particular restriction is going to remain in place.
And as we talk with David Bauerlein, Karen Mathis, Bill Bortsfield, our roundtable this Friday, we want to hear from you. Have you gone into stores and restaurants this week? Did you wear a mask? Did you avoid them? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. John is in Jacksonville. Hi, John. You're on the air. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Okay.
Good. Just the topic of wearing masks. I've recently, you know, I'm in construction. I go into Home Depot, Lowe's, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say 90% of the patrons that go in there are not wearing masks. And even the help in these two locations are not wearing masks. And it's just unbelievable how people have stopped wearing the mask like it just ended May the 1st. The coronavirus went away.
Are you still wearing one, John?
I wear mine 24 hours.
Okay. Thanks, John.
When I'm out anywhere.
Thanks, John. Bill Bortsfield, you know, we should point out that here at WJCT, anyone who comes into the building is asked to wear a mask in the common areas of our building. We have a basket of masks at the front door for those few people that are coming in here every day. You know, but as the caller pointed out, there's no mandate. This is up to individuals and individual businesses to enforce this or to try to maintain this practice. And I, you know, when I go to the grocery store, I see a lot of masks. But I don't know about other businesses. What are you seeing, Bill?
Sort of the same thing. You know, one of the things that our family's been trying to do is take out just to support local businesses. And I've noticed a real mixture. You know, like last week we picked up some pizza and a lady that helped us, she did have a mask, but, you know, it was down around her neck rather than on. A restaurant that we had picked up some food in, although I saw a customer with a mask, the folks that were employees at that moment in time didn't have masks on. So probably like many others, I'm seeing a real variation. And I think part of it's habit. I'll be honest. You know, I've been grabbing mine when I go out, but I did go out once and I forgot to grab it. I just forgot. I probably should have turned around and come back home, but I didn't. I knew it was a quick errand. And I think that's all something that we're all dealing with as a society, is even getting in the habit of doing this, because it's not natural for us. I mean, we miss the facial expressions. They're somewhat uncomfortable, but those are minor inconveniences given what's at stake.
That's right. Karen Mathis, we have had to change our habits and in pretty rapid fashion, and change is hard. People don't like change, but when you talk to the physicians, they really can't stress this strongly enough, that we've got to continue with this. We heard the mayor say this as well. He has been modeling this, wearing a mask when he goes out in public, unlike, say, President Trump or Vice President Pence, who have not. And so when you talk to the business community, what are they saying about this? CEOs and the type of practices they're encouraging at their companies.
Well, they're encouraging, of course, safe practices, and people are encouraged to wear masks, social distancing. This is also kind of an issue because you remember how a lot of businesses were packing people in. You know, you sit together, it's called hoteling at work, you come in, plug in your computer, you're sitting right next to somebody else, your laptop. That's going to be changing. You're not going to see that. You're seeing people being distanced within the office. For instance, our office, you may or may not know, but we have moved during all this, moved downtown, and we have to go in and unpack, and we are going in on separate days, and all of our workstations are very social distance now. We set them all up so that we are a minimum of 6 feet from the other person, and that's what you're going to be seeing in a lot of offices is how do we employ those practices to keep people social distance. You don't want your people to get sick. You just don't. You never do under any circumstance, and especially right now. And Bill's absolutely right. This is going to cause a long-term shift in how people live their lives.
Here is a comment on our Facebook page. Let's say namaste with folded hands and a slight bow, or give the live long and prosper sign. Those are better than a handshake. No germs are exchanged. I like both of those suggestions. Here's an email from Kathleen. I'm concerned that Florida is reopening too soon. We still have a rising count of people with coronavirus and a rising number of deaths. We have inadequate testing and virtually no contact tracing. David Bauerlein, before we go back to more calls, the contact tracing piece of this, that is a huge missing link. The state and local officials are trying to ramp up testing, but contact tracing in other countries, at least, that really was the vital epidemiology piece that helped them get a hold of this public health crisis and get past it. And we just don't have that here in this country at any real level.
Well, that's the ultimate solution to being able to, quote, coexist with the virus is you have it where instead of having a top-down closure of businesses and events and activities, you find a way to do it where you identify people who have the virus and then figure out who they come in contact with, and those are the people who would be quarantined. So it's more targeted. But yes, it's very difficult. There's you have to have an entire system in place. I don't think that's something that really is in place. The question will be, will it be in place by the fall when there are some predictions that there will be a second wave of the coronavirus? And if that's not in place, then you have some difficult decisions about how to handle that, because it's going to be very difficult to come in and do a second time the type of measures that were done over the past 2 months.
Let's go to Peter on the south side. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, hi. My question is about testing. We seem to have an excess capacity for testing, but there's no guidance provided by anyone as to who should be tested. So the only cases that are being reported are the cases of people who are sick. So I could be tested. I think I'm healthy. It could come back negative, but that's just a point-in-time test. But if there was a, I guess, a national health need, so to speak, to find out more about what percentage of the population has the virus, I would go and get tested. But right now, there's an excess of capacity, and I don't feel a need.
Okay, Peter, thanks for that. Bill Bortsfield, let's explain again about testing in Duval County. There are a number of sites where people can go and get tested now, and you've been keeping track of that on our website at wjct.org.
Yeah, of course, the main one is TIAA Bankfield, and of course, they've got the antibody test coming soon. A couple of Walmarts around town have testing. But going back to the caller, you know, I think one of the key things is, as David alluded to, is contact tracing. And, you know, I am a big believer in technology, and I think one of the things that's encouraging is that Google and Apple are working together on this, and certainly it's not a cure-all, but if they do get an effective app out and we can get a majority of the country to download that app fairly quickly, then perhaps we'll have much better coordination about the listener's point about who needs to be tested and when, because then we'll start getting a digital history. And even though, say, I have a test and I didn't test positive, if my cell phone goes off and tells me, whoops, you were just exposed to six people that have it, well, then maybe that's a sign that, oof, now I do need to go and get tested. So that, I would think, is going to be very helpful. And given you've got two of the biggest U.S. tech companies working on it, I would think you're going to see that come fairly soon.
And Joe emails the show, in Duval County, there have only been 26 deaths in a county of nearly 1 million. And this is 150 hospitalizations in a city with literally thousands of hospital beds. This portends a death rate that is less than 1%, he says. He asks that we put that on the air to add a little context. And if you're just tuning in, we are talking about the reopening of Jacksonville and the state with our Friday Media Roundtable. Bill Bortsfield, Karen Mathis, David Bauerlein on with me, and your calls. I'm going to take one more call, and then we'll move on to the other huge story of the week up in Brunswick, Georgia. That in a moment. But first, let's go to Mark in Mandarin. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi. 25% the capacity. I think a store's capacity would have to be large enough to handle the pre-Christmas crowd. So I don't know if 25% of capacity is going to be any kind of limit. And also, you have department stores with multiple entrances from the parking lots and then an entrance on each level from inside the mall. So you would need people at each entrance counting who's coming in and who's leaving. Are they actually going to do that and then do all the, you know, mm-hmm. have some app to determine how many people are in there? Mm. I think at the end of the day, they'll lose count of how many are in there.
Mark, thanks. Hey, Karen, what about Mark's point?
Yeah, I was going to say when I've seen some of the larger department stores, they block off just to one entrance. They if they have four entrances, for example, they will only have one open so that they can manage exactly what he's asking about.
Okay, tweets coming into the show as well. Here are just a couple. Chris writes, how is the city getting a free pass from the local media when there have been 68 new hospitalizations in the last week, a record? The real curve has not flattened. Another tweet, how are states that are opening up early compared to those that are still under lockdown? David Bauerlein, you know, we've heard repeatedly from our state and local officials that Florida has dodged the worst of the virus, and that's what's behind the rationale for reopening. But certainly this is a divisive issue. Not everyone is comfortable with this. In fact, a majority of people polled both in Florida and around the country think that we need to stick with restrictions for some time to come because they are concerned.
Right. And there are restrictions that still are in place. If I could real quickly circle back to the question about testing and who can get tests, you can go to Lot J, the site next to the football stadium, and get tested if you have had contact with somebody who had COVID-19. So it's kind of contact tracing in reverse, kind of voluntary, but for people out there who may have been in the same house or have a friend who had it and they go, well, I don't feel any symptoms, but I wonder if I have it, that is an option for people. And I think in terms of the hospitalization, that I'm not familiar with that particular statistic about that number of hospitalizations in the past week. I know the main figure that people have been looking at is the rate of positive tests. And over the last 14 days of tests results, it's been 1.5% of those tests have come back positive. And that's much lower than it was when this pandemic really started to hit. It's way, way lower than it is in some of the real hot spots like New York or even South Florida. So I think the data seems to show that the virus is not, it has flattened out and it is declining in terms of its spread through the community. So I do think that there is some positive signs in that regard that can warrant, justify moving towards reopening the economy.
Okay, and if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We're going to move forward now and talk about another big headline from the week. In fact, it's one that's from our area but making news around the world. Last night, a father and son, Gregory and Travis McMichael, were both arrested up in South Georgia, and this is in connection with the fatal February shooting of a 25-year-old man named Ahmaud Aubrey. Friends say Ahmaud was killed while he was jogging unarmed in a suburban Brunswick, Georgia neighborhood. Now, that happened back in February, but this case only blew up after cell phone video was leaked online this week that shows this confrontation between Aubrey and the father and son. Travis McMichael is the son of a former district attorney investigator. So the McMichaels, the father and son, had ties to local law enforcement in Brunswick. They appear to confront and shoot down Ahmaud Arbery as he jogs by their pickup truck. The Northside Coalition of Jacksonville is leading a demonstration today over the handling of this case, which is likely to be heard by a grand jury. And Bill Bortsfield, you know, again, this happened months ago, but it was the cell phone video, which apparently was shot by a friend of the father and son. He was parked right behind them. The video release is, and its wide sharing on social media is what led to the wave of outrage. Vice President Joe Biden was in town this week for a virtual town hall, and he called the shooting of Mr. Arbery a shooting in cold blood. Basketball star LeBron James weighed in about this, a lot of other people. And so this is the latest in a long line of shootings of unarmed black men caught on video by white people doing the shooting that have just opened up this long running wound of pain that African Americans in this country have when it comes to trying to get justice. And so we still need to wait to hear the facts of the case, but we will be seeing a demonstration today in Jacksonville, including a motorcade and a news conference on the grounds of the Duval County Courthouse. You've been looking at this as well. When you look at the video, what do you see, Bill?
Well, the video, I think most of us would agree, looks pretty, you know, pretty bad for the folks that have been arrested. I mean, it would appear clear cut, although as a journalist, we always, you know, want to see all the facts and not jump to any conclusions. But, you know, I think that this is just another case that shows how video certainly can be helpful. You know, I was listening to your show when you had Jacksonville criminal defense attorney John Phillips in. And I thought one of the most interesting comments he made was the comparison back to Trayvon Martin, but pointing out a big difference that there's video in this case. And of course, for those that may not remember, in that case, this was another African-American that was gunned down. And George Zimmerman, the shooter, was not ever convicted. But as Mr. Phillips pointed out, key difference here is we do have video in this case. So obviously we'll have to see how it plays out, but I don't think there's any question that body cams and surveillance videos and smartphones are certainly putting things in sharper focus. And this is going to be another case where that's definitely true.
Yeah. David Barreline, that technology has simply changed the game when it comes to justice in these cases, because when the evidence is on video, that just puts so much more pressure than you would have seen in the past. And, you know, we're getting a lot of tweets about this. Here's one from Susan. What about the driver of the car who shot the video? You can hear a gun clip on the video being engaged at 12 seconds. We still have a lot of unanswered questions about the shooter of the video and his motivation.
Right. Absolutely. There's a lot more investigation to go, but it is a case where, let's face it, if this video had not surfaced, this case may well have just been buried. And it does show how the actual video was able to cut through whatever narrative was being put out by the people who shot the jogger, who, of course, was not able to provide any kind of account as well, because obviously he had been killed in this incident. So it does show the power of the video. It's stunning to me that it's taken 2 months to get to this point, given the video's existence.
And right. Really, wait. What about the DA up there who said that the men were justified because they were making a citizen's arrest?
I was going to say that's the other thing, it seems to me, that needs to be looked at in the laws. I mean, the idea that someone can go out with guns and chase somebody down just because they think maybe possibly they were involved in a burglary and come out with guns. I mean, I just don't understand how that particular aspect of the law can allow that kind of latitude for, quote, citizen's arrests. And certainly if I was a jogger and a couple of people came at me with guns, I would be fearful of my life. And then you have a case where then somebody responds to that, and then somebody turns and says, well, I was justified in shooting them because they resisted. Well, this is just a recipe for this type of escalation of violence, and in this case, an allegation of murder.
Linda writes on our Facebook page, I'm horrified and sickened by this. The two men are not the police, the judge, or the jury. And let's go to some of your calls about the arrest of a father and son up in Brunswick, Georgia, in the shooting death of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery. There will be a demonstration about this today at the Duval County Courthouse. Daryl in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl.
Yeah, good morning. These two individuals, according to the attorneys and the sheriff or whoever the authorities were there, were innocent until the video came out. They did not charge them until the video came out, and it came out in public. So the bottom line is that video reveals the truth, and it should be on body cameras, on every police officer, and then we will know the truth about this. Any police chief or sheriff who's says that we need to study this issue more just needs to study this video, and you will see that the video will reveal the facts.
Thank you, Daryl. Apparently, and I'm getting tweets about this, Bill Bortsfield, a defense attorney in Georgia, somehow got a hold of that video and leaked it to a Brunswick radio station who put it online, and then it got shared. So, you know, still a lot of unanswered questions about that. But this is such a painful, painful story for African Americans in this country, because when you go on social media, the pain is so raw, the frustration, the anger, the hurt, the fact that it took the video being shared to actually get the arrests of the alleged killers, rather that it wasn't done right away. You know, people pointing out that if it had been two African-American men who shot a white an unarmed white jogger, the local authorities would likely have handled it very differently. It's hard. You can't deny those. We've just seen this so many times in this country that I think the pain for this, for African-Americans, has just become overwhelming.
No, and it's a bad look for law enforcement up in Glynn County. There's no question about that. I mean, once it went over to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, obviously things moved very quickly as compared to what we saw in the beginning of the case. But I do think there's going to be questions raised, you know, again, why did it take so long to get to this point? I mean, it would have seemed as though there would have been arrests sooner. But again, I have not been following the story that closely, but there's no question that it's a bad look up there. And it's something that this country continues to need to deal with, because, I mean, the statistics of African Americans being arrested are higher, and things like this just really make you wonder, well, what is going on? I mean, but I know we'll see the facts of the case play out, and the video is going to be just a really, really big part of this case. But yeah, there's a lot of underlying things that it just goes to show we still got a long way to go as a society in this country.
Josh emails the show. Melissa, go ahead, Karen.
But I was going to say there really is intense national interest in this. The Wall Street Journal reported it today, so it is on the top of mind of so many businesses and CEOs in the country as well. So this is going to force some change.
Let's hope so. Here's an email from Josh. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation said at their news conference this morning it was clear after 36 hours of investigation there was clear probable cause. Jill in Arlington. Go ahead, Jill. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning. My son's name is Ahmaud, and he's turning 9 on Sunday.
Oh.
And today is Ahmaud, the young man that was murdered. Today is his birthday. He was 26.
Right. He was going to be 26 today.
Yeah. So I just want to say, you know, I prayed, I boohoo cried because I have two black sons. I always pray over them. And I know that his mother prayed over him as well and probably taught him the do's and don'ts. And so I just was like, God, why is this happening? Like, what did we do? You know what I mean? Like, so I just try to just continue to have faith, but it's just nowhere safe for us. My father's from Ghana, and I thought about moving to Ghana, but, you know, it's more socioeconomic over there more than race. And so we feel helpless, and that's all, you know, it's just a helpless feeling. And I know you're an ally, Melissa. You responded to me an email yesterday, and I appreciate that. But we just got to do a better job of empathizing and putting our children, your two daughters, you know, like in the shoes of not my two sons.
Sure.
You understand?
Yeah. And Jill, you know, you have two sons. And so, you know, whenever I talk to folks of color who have children, they tell me they give their kids, you know, the talk. And it's a talk that white parents don't have to give their kids. And so you will have to talk to your sons about how to behave when they ever have an encounter with police or really anyone that might seem to want to do them harm.
And I've already had. We went to Boone Park, and there were some young boys. You know, the kids are out. They had the radio on. A white woman went up to them and said, "Can you turn it down?" The young guy didn't do it. And so she went to call the police. And I said, "Look, don't call the police. When the police come, they come guns blazing. They ask questions later. My two black sons are here. They don't know what two black kids you're talking about." And she got mad at me because I'm telling her this. And so I hope she sees this on the news and it maybe clicks for her what I was saying, and I wasn't overreacting. And I've started, they're 8 and 9. And I started talking to them. I said, "People are afraid of y'all for no reason. So since you know that they're afraid of you, it's not your job to make them feel more comfortable, but it seems like that's what you have to do to live." And this guy, it was nothing he could do. And also I want to note that I read on Vox, two other people had called 911 on him. And they said, "What is he doing wrong?" And they wouldn't answer. So just him being black and just trying to exercise, two other people had already called apart from these people. And they got away with it because it's a good old boy system that's been going on. It's 2020, and it's still happening. And these people need to be fired because they know they murdered him. They covered it up. And this defense attorney, thank God, some kind of way got it and leaked it. They don't care if it's on video or not. And if Biden gets in, he needs to make laws that's very strict on rules and rubrics so that it's universal. You cannot just take a life because you're scared or because you want to.
Jill, I'm so sorry that you're afraid for your sons. And I wish so much that you didn't have that worry. And I want to thank you for your call. Thanks, Jill.
And thank you for being an ally. Thank you for always trying to highlight these issues.
Thank you, Jill. Here's an email from Mark at Mayport. He writes, "Melissa, please point out this is exactly why Colin Kaepernick did what he did." David Bauerlein, you know, that the whole taking a knee thing that Cap started with the NFL, this is why he did it, to call attention to the way African Americans, the perception that they hold, that they are at risk of being killed or injured either by police or really just white Americans. So I want to thank everyone for that feedback. But David, if I could get you on the record about something else that made headlines this week, JEA. Everything old is new again there. The board Tuesday appointed their former CEO, Paul McElroy, to lead JEA once again on an interim basis. At the same time, Jacksonville's Deputy Chief Administrative Officer, Stephanie Birch, is going to give a sworn statement to the Special City Council Committee investigating the failed attempt to sell off JEA. A new document that committee got a hold of shows that top executives at JEA stood to gain huge payouts from that controversial bonus plan that would have gone into effect if the utility had been sold. At the same time, Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci tells WJCT today that Mayor Curry called him Tuesday and asked if the council committee would consider only a Q&A session with Stephanie Birch, but not put her under oath. In the end, the mayor backed down and agreed to allow his employee to speak under oath. So lots happening with JEA right now.
There is a lot happening with JEA. And certainly McElroy coming back, Paul's a known quantity. He's not associated with all those things that you've talked about in terms of everything that happened in the last 2 years. So I think that's the reason why he was put in that place. The investigation, I'm sorry.
No, take a minute. Karen Mathis, or actually Bill Bortsfield, let's go to you. With the pandemic, there's still so much happening in other news, and we just want to make mention of it.
Sure. To me, I mean, you know, the big story of the day as far as the pandemic goes, frankly, is economic, and that's the unemployment numbers. Which came out just a little while ago, let me pull those up for you. The new numbers show 14.7% of the country now is unemployed, with more than 20 million jobs wiped away during the coronavirus. And as the mayor is easing restrictions and saying the businesses can now operate at 25%, it really raises a lot of questions of whether most businesses can even survive on a short-term basis with that little bit of business coming in. 25% isn't a business model that a lot of people are going to be able to survive in, even for a short period of time.
Karen.
And you know, the local numbers will be out in 2 weeks is when the state will be releasing how all of the individual counties fared during April. And that's when we expect to see some pretty big numbers of unemployed people and the drops in the specific categories. And we probably expect to see most of the drops in the retail and the hospitality and in those industries that were on the front lines of being affected and closed down.
All right. And with all of that said, I want to make one more note of something. Today marks the 75th anniversary of Victory in Europe, or VE Day. On May 8th, 1945, when the Nazis surrendered to the Allies. There were going to be celebrations all over the world about this, but the pandemic put the kibosh on that. However, you will get to take part in VE Day today as the Navy's Blue Angels will perform in Jacksonville today. The big flyover starts at 11:40 a.m. over Naval Station Mayport all the way down to Palm Valley. They will fly across parts of Duval, St. John's, and Clay counties, and the flyover will last about 20 minutes. And then they'll head down to Miami and do a flyover there. From Florida, they will sort of skip-scop around the country and do some flyovers, which is kind of cool. And so mark your clock for 11:40 today and try to catch the Blue Angels doing their stuff over our heads. And thank you so much, David Bauerlein, Karen Mathis, and Bill Bortsfield, for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Up next, how one man is hiking all the way across Florida from the peninsula to the panhandle to call attention to this state's unemployment crisis. We'll speak with Bo Guyot next.
Most Vistar branches are open during regular business hours for drive-thru service. For access to safe deposit boxes, check with the branch. Complete listing of branch hours and updates at vistarcu.org/coronavirus. Vistar Credit Union, insured by NCUA.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Public broadcasting is a key source for public safety information, and our firm is pleased to address public safety issues on WJCT.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpenn.com for more information.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview to help brighten your mood, we listen back to my conversation with Steve Martin, recorded after the publication of his memoir, in which he talked about his early years when he was a stand-up comic and how he developed his style of comedy. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm John Dankosky. This week on Science Friday, we've been observing the moon for millennia. So what keeps us gazing upwards?
You know, mountains on Earth, you can imagine mountains on the moon. It's the most accessible astronomical object that we've got to be able to observe.
We'll talk about a new global moon map and ways that you can take a closer look at our celestial neighbor. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
The White House faces questions about another cover-up.
But I should have worn the mask at the Mayo Clinic.
In Phoenix, the president's photo op goes south. Outrage grows over the murder of a black jogger in Georgia, and a California court proves very costly for Quincy. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's the Friday News Roundup on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, don't forget to send mom some flowers this weekend, everyone. One business that's open online right now to help you with that is the new Daughter's Flower Shop in Five Points on Lomax. Yeah, you can get your flowers online or curbside from Daughter's just in time for Mother's Day this weekend. They reached out to me the other day and were telling me their story. It's a woman-owned business who opened just a few months ago, and then the COVID crisis hit. Not great timing. So support them or any locally or especially woman-owned small business in this crisis. Speaking of the crisis, unemployment surged to almost 15% in April, according to the new jobs report out today. That's the highest since the Great Depression. The coronavirus has triggered more than 20 million job losses. And of course, we've all heard the horror stories of tens of thousands of Florida residents being unable to get through to this state's unemployment system to access benefits. One of those extremely frustrated people is South Florida hospitality worker Bo Guyot. He tried to get through to the unemployment website, tried to get through on the phone, no luck. So Bo decided to do something about it. He's calling attention to the crisis by walking across the entire state from the peninsula to the panhandle. His destination is the unemployment headquarters in Tallahassee. We caught up with Bo yesterday. Let's listen. Bo Guyot, thanks for being with us.
Certainly.
So you're like so many other Floridians. You got laid off in this pandemic, and
correct,
you had a really hard time accessing the state unemployment system like thousands of other people. So you're expressing your frustrations by walking across the state. How'd you hit on this idea?
So as you said, the frustration was building. Nobody really was upset first, I say, week or two, because it was just so unprecedented. But then, you know, people started getting letters about missing information. I was sent a letter personally about questioning my identity. People were trying to get answers. No one was answering the phone. And then you couldn't get on the website. So information was being lost, pins were being lost, social security numbers were being lost, so on and so forth. So I contacted or made attempts to contact really anybody I could. There's a WhatsApp thread that all my coworkers are on. And before COVID, this was used to disseminate information about schedules, anything that was happening in the hotel and the restaurant. And now it's been turned into an information thread for really in regard to the DEO, because to this day, up until yesterday, you know, there was probably a tenth of my coworkers that had received any kind of money whatsoever or any information. So next, people were getting deemed ineligible, but they weren't being given answers. So it was you received an ineligibility message, but then it asked you to reapply. It didn't state why you were ineligible.
And so
it just
so nobody has any information, and they're not getting any money, which is your situation.
Nobody has any information. Nobody has exactly.
So you're
exactly.
out of you
and
can't.
There's no way to reach them.
Yeah, and no way to follow up. So, in the frustration of that, you just decided to call attention to it by walking across Florida, starting out from South Florida and making your way up to Tallahassee.
Correct.
Where are you now?
I'm in Gainesville. So I will be walking around Gainesville today, visiting with as many people as I can. And then my next major stop is Lake City.
And your goal is to, when you get to Tallahassee, to go to the DEO, the Department of Economic Opportunity, where all the problems are?
The goal is to take these stories that we placed on Instagram from businesses, from people that still haven't received an answer from the DEO, and present those to our state officials, right? Because somebody needs to hear those stories. And I've mentioned this before to several folks. When you're walking around outside, especially that is that a lot of folks are back to some extent in business. So when you're driving around, walking around, biking around outside, grocery stores open, what you're not seeing are the thousands and thousands of people that work in hotels and restaurants that are unable to work because of the order, especially in the southern counties where we're really, you know, nothing in hospitality is open. I have tirelessly been trying to get in contact with the DEO regarding a volunteer program. And all I'm looking to do is have them train me on the phones and on the application process like they've done with, from what I understand, some type of outsourcing to handle the volume. And I want to help people get approved and get in help them get their money, help them see their benefits, which they've been waiting, some have been waiting for months now.
Now, what has this journey been like for you? You've been walking for how many days now?
Saturday was 2 weeks, which is originally, you know, when you're sitting at home and you're trying to map something like this out, you know, I came across so many variables, let's say, on the way up. So my original plan was to be up here in about 12 or 13 days, or I should say in Tallahassee in 12 or 13 days. I more than likely won't be in Tallahassee until early next week. But that doesn't matter. The stories I'm getting and the things I'm hearing from people are amazing. We have a mix of testimonials on the Instagram page.
I want everyone to check out your Facebook and Instagram pages, and they can follow along on this journey, The Walk to Tallahassee. Just search for that page, The Walk to Tallahassee, chronicling Bo Guyot's walk across Florida, which he's been doing for a couple of weeks now to call attention to the state's unemployment crisis. We're going to keep following this, Bo, and we are really curious to see what happens when you reach the state capitol. So thank you for dropping in with us on your journey. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. And if you just let people know that they can message through Instagram and Facebook, and we will get in touch with them, and they'll be heard on one, if not both, the pages.
So check that out and make sure to tune into the Florida Roundup today at noon. We'll have an update on unemployment issues in Florida then too. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Catch our podcast at WJCT.org if you missed any part of today's show, and have a great weekend, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.